Combining a double degree in computer science and applied statistics with an eye for business, Abdel Tefrij has built his career by being at the intersection of data science and product management. Over the years, he's worked internationally in France, West Africa, and the United States, holding down titles like lead consultant, head of analytics, chief product officer, chief innovation officer, and these days, chief technology officer. Along this journey, he's worked for the likes of the Home Depot, Career Builder, and Dumpsters.com. These days, though, Abdel has taken the leap to build his own startup called Data Bid Machine, which uses deep learning to power ad campaigns. Be sure to stick around as we catch up with Abdel Tefrij and hear how this once upon a time master soap maker became a data scientist and tech startup co-founder.
You're listening to the Developmentor podcast, hosted by Grant Ingersoll. We have one goal on the show, to help you build a successful career in tech, no matter where you're from or where you're going. We do this by showcasing interesting people working across a variety of roles in tech and deep dive into their why. If you want to learn more, please visit our website at developmentor.com or follow us on Twitter at @developmentor.
Welcome to the show, Abdel. Great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
And I know we're still recording this in the middle of COVID, and I certainly hope you're doing well. But as we were reflecting off show, I believe we last saw each other in person at the Activate conference in Montreal. Is that right?
That's correct.
And I think you were at Home Depot at the time, so a lot's obviously changed in the meantime. And I also understand you've got a little bit of something to celebrate today, something about Liverpool. Is that right?
Yeah, 30 years in the making. I'm beyond excited. 30 years we've been waiting for this championship.
For our listeners here, Abdel, of course, is talking about football or soccer, as we Americans call it, right? And is that right?
That's right.
Yeah, well, you must be so excited. So that's fantastic. Well, let's dive in because, you know, I mean, one of the things that's interesting here, Abdel, you know, resumes and profiles, they only tell part of this story. And you know, looking at your profile, I think there's probably a good place to start, which is before you actually came to the U.S., before you did that computer science degree at DePaul, I see these entries around your profile, things like chief operating officer. I see France. I see West Africa. I would love for you to start us off with that. What was going on with Abdel before getting into tech?
What was going on is when I graduated from high school, I decided to do apprenticeship system, which is common in Germany and France. You can go from high school. In Germany, like 60% of the kids go from high school to apprenticeship system in manufacturing, and later maybe get to college if not. So I took the same path, and I got into soap. Believe it or not, I can make soap. I'm a soap maker, went through a certification for a French group and African group that sent me across West Africa to run soap manufacturing because I was an intersection of two cultures. I grew up in a French public school systems, but my family is from all over Africa. So I was able to bridge two worlds. It was an exciting experience. I put in a lot of hours. And then what was exciting, I had to build factory in different country. So every 2-3 years, we kept expanding. So it was a great experience because it's a lot of it was engineering. Manufacturing engineering, research it, reading engineering, building machines sometimes. It could be how do you cool off the water in a heat season to cool off the machine. I mean, I got very deep into more, I would say, industry engineering. I got my sort of certificate for industry engineering and soap making.
That was all through apprenticeship. Is that right?
That's correct.
So interesting. Well, you know, it's funny, Abdel, because in your email, you said, oh, I can talk about my background in soap. And I was like, huh, you know, for us developers, soap was a thing like in the, I don't know, the early 2000s or something. I'm like, does Abdel really want to talk about that kind of soap? But no, you literally mean like body wash and cleaning.
Body wash. Not soap, the web services. Like literally, I remember writing code in soap. I was joking with people that I literally made a body wash.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, I'm curious, you know, before we get into the tech side, I mean, you know, you mentioned so many good lessons in there. What are some of the things that stand out that have actually served you in the rest of your career from that apprenticeship and from that time manufacturing soap?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing, I didn't have financial, I didn't have much choice. So I didn't have the option of follow your passion, follow the things. So I went to soap. From soap, we expanded into oil, water. I kept learning and doing things, and they kept promoting me. So what I've learned early on in my career, I think one of the myths, I told this to my kids and the people I mentor, is not follow your passion. It's follow your effort. Solve problem for others. What is the problem your customer, people are willing to spend money on? What's the pain point? So my career took me in different sector of manufacturing, from soap maker to oil, to margarine, to water treatment. I went to different things. So I think you have to be curious. You have to be patient. You have to have a beginner mind to rely on the expert around you. And then if you solve enough problem, I never really updated my resume. People always call me for a job or I get placement. If you over-deliver things that are in front of you, you will succeed.
And here I was trying to think about how to make a pun about oil and water coming together. You actually worked on both oil and water while you were there. So I love that. Well, so then, okay, so you're in France, you're in West Africa, you're working across so many different manufacturing processes. And then, you know, along comes tech. You know, what inspired you to get into tech and how did you make that leap from manufacturing into, all right, hey, I'm going to go to the US, I'm going to take computer science at DePaul, I'm going to get into a completely different field from what I, you know, quote unquote, grew up in?
Actually, it's funny how the world works. I was managing at the end of the factory. I moved up to managing director. I had all sort of engineer, industry engineer, mechanical engineer. Some of them have degree. I didn't have degree. And they were a painful IT engineer that keep reminding me that I don't have a degree, that I don't understand IT. And he was a little bit arrogant. So he treated everybody as second citizen. He tried to create a caste system in the company that, as you know, sometimes engineers get caught up in their ego thing, the creativity. So every time we ask him for project, he make everything more complex. And he remind me, even though I was his boss, how I don't have a degree, I don't understand what I don't understand industry engineer, I don't understand IT. Because it was such a pain to deal with, I went and learned programming. I started learning Access on my own, just to test them. I gave him a project. He said it will take 3 months. I actually did it in a month with the help of friends, just to prove him wrong. So by doing it, actually, I started enjoying it. Actually, I'm finding myself enjoying this new emerging world. And in between, how this link from the factory in Africa to US, I used to do a lot of development, product development for factory. I go to village to see what the market need. I ran into Peace Corps, the Peace Corps. And you know, one of the things that I skipped college. So I find this in the Peace Corps, I used to hang with Peace Corps. My college year, people my age, because when I was working in the factory, I used to hang people out much older than me. And I end up married with one of them, Angela. So once we have a first kid, she's like, you gotta go back in the US. When I land in the US, 28, one kids, I'm starting over. And then there was a revolution in one of the country in Togo. Angela's like, I don't care what you have to do. I'm not staying here. I don't care if you're in the street. So, I mean, for somebody who grew up in 11 countries, I mean, that's another country. For me, I'm like a nomad. For me, traveling is not. I view myself as a citizen of this world. I have 5 passports. I'm like, yeah, I'm for the adventure. I went in the U.S. So I landed in the U.S. 28. Then I decided to do some homework. One of the things that helped me, besides follow your effort, some of the principles I have is follow the money, follow the customer. What's the big problem the world need? Then I noticed, I researched what job are growing and technology kept coming up. Then I decided, okay, I'm 28. I'm starting over. Nobody cares about manufacturing. But also I was burned out dealing with the union. I'm like, I'm not going to go back in manufacturing. I want to go in services. Then I decided to look at which industry have the highest margin. My wife is like, why is researching industry have margin? I'm like, look, I'm 28. I'm starting over, I'm doing my degree in computer science. I need to figure out which industry have the highest margin so I can jump in those industry and increase my salary faster. So I decided to test finance, healthcare, energy, tech. I avoid transportation other industry at the time that have low margin. I tried the finance while I was in college. I noticed Wall Street is getting automation. I didn't like the culture. Tried the healthcare, I did an internship. It was too slow for my personality. Then I kept trying, and then I tried click commerce. They were doing early e-commerce. I jumped in that. And then I was a developer. 28, I was dealing. I like to go learn coding, and I just find it fascinating. Coming from engineering background, I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed school. I think I had a blast learning new programming. I was focusing on C++, Visual Basic, and early SQL Server. So, and then we end up building a portal. Then from the portal, I was managing large accounts like Motorola and Honeywell. And then Honeywell was my big customer. I jumped with them. I almost jumped with Motorola. I'm glad I jumped with Honeywell. Because my wife told me, once a kid, second kids were 5, 6, 8, she basically signed me up for soccer. She signed me as a coach. She wanted me to stop working for startup. I was addicted to startup, workaholic. She said, you got to go work for a big company where everybody get up 5 so you can have life balance. She signed me up as a coach. So when I was late, 20 parents yelled at me. So I did the things. So that's why I realized also, it's not about chasing the money and chasing the things. At one point in life, teach you that you have to figure out what's your priority in life at that moment and adjust. I didn't let my drive or my ego, I tried to figure out how to balance it. And I think at that time, even though I was rambling, I was against that decision with my wife, looking back now that my kids are older, I'm grateful I did those decisions. I'm grateful I left the startup world, went to Honeywell for 4 or 5 years. I was a little bit bored at the end of 5 years. And then there were career builder who were using similar system. They kept trying to hire me. They're like, look, this is not too small. It's not too big. So it was $200 million. It was perfect. It was growing double digit. Then I went jump a career builder. Again, I was an entrepreneur. I went there as a CRM manager just to try to balance lifestyle. Once my kids become a teenager, I was going to jump to a startup. My CEO, my boss at the time, told me, we want to start a new division. Why don't you run with it? Supply and demand. That's where I hired a friend, Trey, Khalifa. I had a massive data science team. We had a blast. We took a product, supply and demand, with McNair, Trey, High. Some people, you know them already. We scaled it from zero to $100 million. We pushed the envelope with Solr using data analytics. We combined BI and search and data science. I'm like, I discovered a new passion. That passion led me to Home Depot, because half of those team went to Home Depot doing search and recommendation. And that similar things in a budget dumpster. Again, search, digital acquisition, same background. And that led me to data building. It's funny how if you solve enough problem, door open up for you. But instead of chasing your goal, your passion, just solve a problem that in front of you and door will open up. I'm going to pause here.
No, I love that. And so if I picked up early, so after you got your computer science degree, you did some work in software engineering. And then, you know, it's kind of interesting, Abdel. I mean, one of the things on this show I often talk about is people who come into engineering roles from other degrees. Like, so we've had English majors turn programmers, things like that. And I'm not even quite sure how to ask this question, but like, you know, you've kind of gone from computer science and engineering up into other kinds of roles, like analytics, obviously is pretty adjacent, but more focused on the product management, growing out and building products, doing analytics. I'm curious of how have you thought about your career and how has computer science factored into that once you've really started thinking and building out that career and decided you didn't want to spend as much time programming, perhaps?
I think even like ClickCommerce and Honeywell, I was finding myself, I find a lot of IT department have a gap. The business unhappy, the IT guy unhappy, they're like, this guy's an idiot, they don't understand the requirement. People think, there is always a gap. I find myself closing that gap. And then I always told myself, stay close to the customer. I don't like to be between proxies. So when I meet the end customer, it just generate, build in me an intrinsic motivation. At the end of the day, I tell people this. I did that for all my engineers that I were under me. They will tell you this. I took them in front of customer and customer. Every engineer. I insist to do that. Because what happened, at the end of the day, you become engineer, you want to have an impact on this world. And I believe magic happens when people who are building the tool meet people who are using it. And for me, it just generated a lot of intrinsic motivation. So let me tell you a story about this. When I was doing the supply and demand, I had a small team of engineers, 5. And the CEO and CTO asked me, they're like, unless we notice your engineer never in the office and they're always working. They're always going to client meeting. The other engineer don't understand why you do that. I said, man, Eric, let me give you why I do that. I used to travel to meet, let's say, American Express. The night before, we'll have a client dinner. Client tell me, oh, this, I love your tool, but this is there is a bug here, bug here. So I'll be in my hotel all night, try to convince them to fix it, share my screen, send them screenshot. What I noticed, when I take every trip, when I start taking a trip to those customers, I take one engineer with me. You know what happened, Graham? I would sit to 1 o'clock, try to convince back and forth, back and forth. When I take the engineer with me, he hears that. He pull up his laptop in the dinner. Then I go to bed. I told my boss at 9 o'clock. The engineer go 1 o'clock in the morning. And then the thing is fixed much faster. So there is something about people who are building something. And then, you know, a lot throughout my career, people complain about engineers. They're super introvert. They're not motivated. They just want to build things. They don't want to solve problems. I'm like, did you expose them to the customer? This is built in me now. It's like I'm wired. It's one of my principles. And then that motivated the engineer. And then I just feel like it created urgency and immediacy. And then it created motivation. And then the baseline and it created customer satisfaction.
I love that. That's something I did at LucidWorks as well, which is putting engineers in front of customers whenever you can. Maybe not whenever you can, but at least frequently. Having engineers do training or doing customer support, like that, building that empathy, it makes you such a better engineer. I bet your engineers will thank you for that after the fact now, right?
Yeah, I was driving them crazy. But listen, my biggest accomplishment, like I don't know how I'm going to have limited time on this earth. My biggest accomplishment, Grant, is half my engineer leader over my career own their own business. Like Alex Trey own his own business, Adam Polosak, Vojo CTO founder. So all his engineer, Nagini, Melissa, Ellen, all these guys that I've worked over the years, I is executive leader that having high impact career who own their own business. Glenn Anderson, I work with them. So all these guys that own their business, because I told them it's not, I keep drilling the head. It's not about building something. It's solving problem for the customer.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, it's so important. I think it, for the engineers listening, I can't emphasize this enough. It's probably single-handedly one of the things that most propelled my career forward as well.
Are you missing tech conferences? I know I am. I miss meeting so many great people and hearing and learning from talented speakers from around the world. Well, you are in luck as there is a new online series of conferences from Manning Publications called Live at Manning that is aimed at filling your live learning needs. As many of you know, Manning has been a great supporter of the show, offering up free books and discounts for our listeners. We've teamed up with them as a media sponsor this time to spread the word on this new series. These conferences are free to attend, filled with talks from some really great tech experts, and streamed globally via Twitch. No travel needed. Next up in the Live at Manning series is a one-day event focused on the Rust programming language. It is on September 15th, starting at 12 p.m. Eastern. This is your chance to hear from speakers like Carol Nichols, who is a member of the Rust Core team, as well as other Rust experts and authorities, including Michael Hasenblas, who you heard here on Developmentor in episode 55. Head over to developmentor.com/RustCon, all one word, to find out more. In case you didn't catch that, there of course will be a link in our show notes. We hope to see you there.
I'm curious, though. So you've got your computer science background, you're going to Career Builder, you're doing all of these, you know, building businesses, building products. And then, you know, in the midst of all this, you then also decide to go get an MBA, a Master's of Business. I'm curious, kind of where were you at? You know, I think a lot of our listeners often say, ask the question, should I get a graduate degree? How does it factor into my career? I'm curious to hear your thought process around getting an advanced degree.
I think for me, Matt Ferguson, my CEO at the time, my boss, forced me to do it. He's like the company sponsor. And he's like, look, you read a lot about business. By the way, I read an academic paper, and then I read Wall Street Journal, Economist, Fortune Magazine, Business Week. I'm a vicious reader. I love to read. That's my passion. He said, the MBA will give you validation that you understand the business. Plus, it will give you a bigger network. You like to network. That's the biggest value for me was network. And then the people that you meet. And then also, you're in a learning environment. I like to read and learn. And then the more you learn, the more you realize, like I told you earlier again, everything we know either is incomplete or wrong. So you always got to have this beginner mind.
Yeah, expand on that a little bit more and tell me a little bit more about what that means to you.
I think meaning that there is a lot of new perspective. Like I like to form now growth team in most company I work with, which mean cross-functional team. When you become an expert in a domain, you stop listening. You see a few possibilities. That's a Zen mindset. And then what happened? You shut down because you think you have the answer. But things are evolving so fast, it's hard for a person to keep up. So like what I did is over the years, even though I moved between data science, business, product, you know what I did, Graham? Well, secret in my network, I stay in touch with the smartest architect. I have in my network 20 architects, developer that I knew who were going to stay technical the rest of life. I call them regularly when I have a problem. And then I realize I'm reading Adam Grant's book, when he described in one of his books that we all have a domain. And a lot of people who are smart people think they can succeed in many domains. So you got to realize your limitation of knowledge. And then who do you rely on in other your blind spot to solve your blind spot? And then how do you keep your knowledge learning? Because in the technology field, in data science, especially data science, I feel like things are accelerating with velocity. You cannot keep up.
And by the way, for our listeners, when Abdel says he likes networking, he is not lying. I mean, I think I've seen this person, I've seen Abdel network, and it is truly amazing to watch the way he makes connections. And I'll say too, like, I think a lot of engineers hear the word networking and they think it kind of sounds, you know, I don't know, it's not honest or true. But I think, like, Abdel, like, tell us a little bit about how you approach networking, because there's a sincerity to it that I think makes it genuine and heartfelt. So tell maybe a couple of tips on around how you approach networking.
I come from a large family. So coming from a large family teach you how to network. And generally, I love people. I love people. I love to learn. I think the fastest way to learn is actually not reading. It's actually talk to people. So that's some principle. And then growing up in 11 country, I went to different high school. I had to figure out how to quickly network. Because I was always different. I'm a mixed race. I was always the outlier. So it actually helped me. And then I had a traumatic experience when I was running the factory. So let me explain you. Two traumatic experiences in my life. One for the reading and one for the networking. It built it in me. So the reading, my parents were illiterate. I didn't pay attention when I was 8, 6 to high school. I was raised by almost my dad when he was older by my brother and sisters. I was not keen in reading. My brother sent me to a boarding school in France. I couldn't read properly. The kids, you know, nothing beat the kids, man. They were vicious. They called me the illiterate because I couldn't read properly. They motivated me. You know, and I was so mad. They kept calling me in the boarding school illiterate. I called my dad. My dad was like, what are you going to do about it? Do you want to come back to Africa or you want to stay there? Do something about it. So what I started doing, then I started reading everything that I come across. I developed a habit. So if you look, put a paper in front of me, a magazine, I will literally grab it everywhere I see. I developed the habit. I remember the last grade in a class in France, the system is terrible in high school because they return the grade, they tell you loudly. I will always have the lowest class a grade in French and things. And the last class, I had the highest grade. When the teacher says, I'm like, I'm illiterate. I can't hear you. Can you say that loudly? So every time I have skeptic, it motivates me. So this helped me understand the importance of reading. The network, I had a predisposition coming from a large family and my personality. But then when I was running a factory in Africa, there was a revolution one time. There was no enough raw material. The boat couldn't come. We were importing everything. I had 100 people that depend on me. They came visit me, my house. I had to do temporary layoff. Some of them were hungry. So I had to give my own money to the workers. So I decided I would never let happen this again. I have to have plan B, C, D, E, F. So when this was happening, I went to a factory next to me that was run by German, Norwegian. I went to the German guys, like, I need to borrow some raw material. He's like, who are you? I learned a lesson that you need to network because you cannot solve all world problems. If you network, it's people that can help you. So I built a relationship with them after I finally solved my problem. I built a soccer team for all expatriates. I host parties. So what I did is build trust with them. Then I told them, look, we got to help each other in a chemical exchange. We got to tell everybody what inventory you have. Once I earned that trust and they realized that we can help each other. And then all of us, when there was other revolution boat, we always help each other in chemicals. So I learned early on that if you want to go fast, we have say in Africa, you go alone. If you want to go far, you go together. You cannot solve problem by yourself. So the power of having experts, things, it can take you far. And then they're saying Silicon Valley is not what you know, is who do you know? Silicon Valley is a cluster of network.
I'm still just in awe of, like, you're doing all of this while the country is in the middle of a revolution. Did I hear that right?
Yeah, revolution, yeah.
And we think we have hard problems here sometimes. I can't even imagine what that's like, Abdel. So thank you so much for sharing that. One of the things that kind of comes out of this then is when I often think about product management, I often think about it as this role that is, shall we say, in the middle of everything. It's in the middle of a lot of different stakeholders, and they're all pulling you in a lot of different ways. You know, you've got your customers, you've got your engineers, you've got finance, who's like, you've got delivery dates, all of these things. And I'm curious, how do you approach product management? How do you think about the role? How do you think about the skills necessary to be successful in product management?
I think first, let me just tell you, I made a lot of mistakes early on product management when I shift from engineering to product manager because I want to solve every problem. I didn't know how to prioritize. So, you know, somebody told me you become an expert in domain when you made every mistake possible. I made every mistake you can imagine. Some dumb mistake. The biggest thing that I've learned over the years for product management, I call that principle, follow the money and prioritization. Meaning follow the money. We all are constrained by time, resource, budget. I think it's really the role of product manager. What are the top three things you can do that are going to have the biggest impact? I tell product manager early on, when you talk to an engineer, more than 10 features, you overwhelm them. Narrow them to top three things. Three, maximum five. And then do you validate with at least five customers? So I think for me, that is essential. The core thing as a product person, how do you take all the stakeholders and net it out? Here is the top three things and why we should do this. And here is the impact.
How do you typically approach that impact question? Because I know that can be tricky. I'm curious as to how you think about impact.
I'll tell you what I did at Career Builder, but also what the company that does it best is Amazon. Out of everybody I've interacted with over the years, I have even a template that I can share with you. They ask, walk backward from the customer. What's the customer experience? Before you write the code, estimate the market size and talk to at least 5 to 10 to any customer. Do the press release. So having the press release, what the future with a quote from customer. Make sure that project, you have the end goal in mind, the end user in mind, and then work backward from it. So the impact, you can get it through a market research, but I think you can get through market research, estimate. But I think the biggest thing is really what I find through over the years and through Amazon is ask 5-10 customer what they're willing to spend. Just go check with the end user and the buyer. Then you can easily estimate it. But the second thing you can do is get the data whenever it's possible. If it is existing product, if product or customer already using it, go find the data impact. And you'll be amazed how many companies don't look at their own data.
That's fantastic, Abdel. I think you hit on some really key pieces there. And by all means, if you have a template to share that's publicly available, we certainly can link that up in the show notes. So I'd love to share that with our listeners because I think that would be hugely instructive. I've been in engineering orgs who don't always get at the impact of features or functionality or even product. Over the long run can be quite demoralizing. So I appreciate you sharing that. Shifting gears there a little bit, I mean, and perhaps this is a segue into that, you know, we're talking about being demoralized, and obviously the opposite side of that is being invigorated, and you've held leadership roles and management roles for quite some time, so I'm curious as to how you think about the key lessons you've learned in being a leader and being a manager. How do you motivate your teams? How do you think about building your teams? Kind of what's that overarching narrative of Abdel as a manager, if you will?
I think at the beginning, I made a lot of mistakes also there. What I've learned over the years, it took me a while to understand Napoleon have a definition of leadership. It took me years to appreciate it. Leader provide two things for their team, clarity and hope. Clarity is what we just discussed, the OKR, the impact. Hope, I think, is a vision. The future is going to be greater. Where we're heading. I think if you can do those two effectively, people will follow you. And then the third thing that we discussed earlier, you show them the impact of their work. I think too many people lose motivation when they don't see the impact of their work.
I'm curious, like, how on the hope side do you approach that? You know, especially like, you know, like, hey, we're in the middle of a pandemic right now. There's global protests against systemic racism. How do you approach navigating when things are dark, if you will? You mentioned you made a bunch of mistakes there. I'm curious as to how you approach that question of leading your team through challenging times.
I think show your vulnerability, show that you don't have all the answer, and be just show that you're human. Go with them, show, hey, look, I don't have all the answer, what do you think? General Eisenhower said the best way to influence somebody is ask them for advice. What would you do in my position? Listen to their concern. And then also what I find early on, especially new engineer, when I promote a new engineer leader, they tend to be fixating about people's weakness or try to just address weakness. I'm like, no. We all have weakness. How you leverage everybody's strength. So having the combination of positive and reinforcement, and then just ask people how they're doing, ask them about the whole person, about their life. I met most of my top talent, I met their parents. I went visit their house, met their partner, wife, husband. I have some of them. I went to India. I went visit a couple of my, I took my own personal trip. I went visit some of them, the parents, in their own town, the village. I did the same thing in Paris. Know the whole person, invest in them. Once you do that, people will follow you. If the people know that you care about them, they will follow you.
And that's often what leads to that hope then, right? Is that they have hope that the team can figure it out, which I think is so important.
You can ask Trey. I drove him crazy when he worked with me. And I told him at the beginning, I'm going to drive you crazy. But Trey, one day you're going to own your own business. One day I'm going to drive you crazy because I'm not just a typical. And then look, I enjoy meeting his kids, his daughter. I told him I want to adopt one of his daughter. When you do that, same thing with Wojciech. There's other people I'm going to introduce you, Glenn. When people know that, I don't know, there is some trust you built in them. Once you build that trust, you find commonality. And when you get harsh on them or be demanding, people understand the context. At the end of the day, as a leader, your job is to set the context.
I'm just coming out of budgeting for where I'm at now. And so much of it is about like setting that context and framing the path forward and showing people impact. So you hit on some things that are just very personal to what I'm going and working on right now. So I love that and sharing that with our listeners. And by the way, for our listeners, Abdel keeps referring to Trey. His name is Trey Granger. He's someone both of us have worked with who has a great and fantastic profile. And one of these days I'll have him on the show as well. But we'll be sure to link up Trey's profile here just so you all have context there. You know, I mentioned in the lead-in, you know, you've worked for a number of large companies. I think you gave some stories there around you did some startups, then you went to the big companies. And then these days, you know, you're back into being a founder and being at a startup. So tell us that founding story about DataBid Machine. Tell us what it's all about and give us the background on the why behind that company.
So actually, it's funny. As you know, Grant, I, with a couple of friends, data science, I helped run one of the data science conference, Silent Data Science Conference. And one of the things that I'm finding myself doing now, I tell all this data science, they're all PhD. I'm the only one advising who's not PhD. So I call myself PhD wannabe. And then how do I build trust? You know, talk about network and trust. How do you build trust with data science? You got to read that paper. So whenever we organize data conference, I read the paper. Because a lot of those guys, there is nothing data scientists love more than you write this paper and make a specific comment. A couple of years ago, I read one from Airbnb, I think, and Google. They wrote a paper about Google traffic acquisition automation. And at the time, I was running the user traffic at I can't remember which company, basically, and then describe how they automated. So we met at a conference, and sometimes to connect the dot, you have to collect the dot. And then I'm like, oh, that's interesting. If you leave Airbnb, call me. He left. We discussed it. We decided, because everywhere I went, I support marketing. And then I realized marketing is doing everything manually to acquire traffic through Google. Google, on the other hand, and Facebook, they have a deep learning machine, so it's hard for the human to keep up. And then you know, you and I know, we work in search. It's hard for the human in log search to keep up with a long tail. If you want to buy traffic on Google, everybody bid for the headquarters, but the money is actually in the long tail. But nobody can keep up with the long tail. So how do you take the long tail, apply it to some data science, some deep learning, clustering those keywords, and then go and buy those keywords? They come in a smaller volume, but they come with higher intent. And if you can scale that, usually what we've seen is customer getting 30, 40% higher, more click, and a lower cost. So we've been testing it and preparing this model for 2-3 years. So we deployed it, me and a couple other co-founder. I'm sort of more the board member. Now we have a general manager. The team is sort of self-independent. When they need me, I just sort of intervene.
So you're not in the day-to-day operations as much as...
No, I am in between gigs. I am in it, but I'm like advisor. But it's a team that I've been together almost for two years.
That's interesting. I didn't see. This is some of the things I mentioned at the beginning. The profile doesn't always tell the story. So I appreciate that very much. Well, so then that begs the question, you know, how are you spending the rest of your time these days?
I'm finding myself advising several companies. I can't mention some of them name, but one of them, you know, I'm enjoying it. All the knowledge that I have, all the mistakes that I did, all this network, to your point, a lot of people want to tap in my network. I'm getting VC calling me and they're like, oh, once you help enough people, networking is about giver than the taker. If you give, door will open. Over the years, people just call me. All I did is, because of my data science network, I introduced them, so talk to. Now people, I'm calling them, they're like, they pick up the phone. People are like, man, you can call a lot of people and every company, they pick up the phone. I'm like, you know why they pick up phone? Because for years you helped them. And Graham, you know the Saturn Data Science Conference with Khalifa and those guys that you know. This year, we might have got 1,000 people, more than 1,000. We started like literally 4 years ago, just to tell you how things work in life. I went to my data science in Atlanta. They kept traveling to the West Coast and East Coast for conference. I told Trey and those guys, if you guys stop traveling, I will set up a conference here as a joke. I was just trying to prove a point that the traveling too much make a point. They're like, well, why don't we set it up? I'm like, shit, I shouldn't have made that joke. The first year, we had 45 people. Next year, we have 300. Last year, we have 700. It's funny how it works. Then you build a network. Now people want to be part of this network.
That's so true. Well, so actually, give a little more context on Southern Data Science Conference, because you just explained it a little bit. But like, tell us a bit more about that conference and who's it for, because I think a lot of our audience here would actually be interested in attending.
So I think what we did is we went to a lot of conferences, a lot of us. We noticed a lot of conferences. Reinforce the sort of the silo thinking. When you go to those large conferences, there is a path for the business, there is a path for the data science, for the engineer sessions. What we try to do here, we want to do like a growth team. We bring a different expertise, we bring people of different background, and we have one main session purposely because we want to expose them to the different area. The key for innovation is cross-functional team. Diversity of gender, diversity of thinking, diversity of different background. Because my whole background, the reason why I was able to come up with solutional things, because I work in different industry and you apply. Too many industry, too many people stay in silo. And then there is like a herd mentality. They replicate the same thing they see with other industry. Innovation comes from people who come from a different industry. I mean, I love this quote of Steve Jobs. I'll send to you a grand letter. Steve Jobs said he had the biggest impact when he came back. He did education, he did movies, he did different things. That's how he built the ecosystem at Apple. iTunes came from an education program he tried to set up. So he described creativity as people who work in many industries and who can easily connect the dots. So I'm trying to do that with Saturn Data Conference. We try to replicate the same model, exporting people from cross-functional background to the six. But then we try to do applied data science, industry focus, and combine that. And we try to bring some leading speaker from Amazon to Google to people, Baidu. And we try to bring people from all over the world.
I love that model. That's exactly what I'm trying to do with this show as well, is showcase all these diverse backgrounds, because like you said, it's all cross-functional these days. And the better you can operate cross-functionally, the better off you're going to be. So I appreciate that very much. For our listeners, we'll link that up. I'm just curious, with COVID and the pandemic, are you still planning a in-person event, or is this going to be online this year?
No, we've been doing more online, and we've been breaking smaller session. Again, this is why Winston Churchill said, "Don't never let a crisis go wasted." So we rescheduled it, but there was so much demand. Khalifa and some of them ended up doing a session online, and 800 people attended. So what I love about this world, a lot of people are hungry for knowledge. You know, people get paralyzed by COVID, but actually I'm amazed how much is going to moving everything online. It's going to expose everybody to a bigger world and more knowledge, if anything.
For sure. I mean, if we thought we were connected before, I agree. Like, it's going to force a lot more of that deeper connections. You're going to see a lot of good things come out of this pandemic, for sure.
Yeah, I'm expecting more innovation, more startup. out of this, like I said you earlier, but COVID is going to drive more innovation. It's going to drive more startup. It's going to drive more change. People are willing to change. They're willing to do more. Digitization can accelerate. And then if you look at throughout human history, Bill Gates said, the massive change happened when there is massive innovation in energy, healthcare, telecommunication, and transportation. So COVID is going to impact healthcare, transportation, and telecommunication. People are doing more Zoom. In just Zoom, more people from all over the world showing up. Before, we were bound by having people visit us in Atlanta. Now there is no boundary. Friend told us, can I refer to somebody in Indonesia, in Malaysia, in Timbuktu? I do not know. But we have people all over the world showing up for those classes online. It's a beautiful thing.
It's so beautiful. Now, if only somebody could fix time zones so we could all be awake. Abdel, kind of bringing this home, want to shift gears a little bit. And I love asking people this question, maybe catch you a little off guard. But what's been the most surprising thing about your career to date?
I think it's just a basic human trait. What I find, it took me years to understand that, common sense is not common. A lot of people try too hard to follow their passion, what they want. I tell people, listen, anybody you meet around the world care about two things, themselves and their problem. If you want to succeed in this world, don't talk about your product, these things. Talk about their problem, rub in their problem, and then give them medicine to fix their problem. When you start with your product, you give them vitamin. Yeah, I think I like that, but you don't tie it. It's at the end of the day, innovation is about solving problems. Fell in love with the problem, I tell this engineer, not your solution. And I'm amazed how many startups, how many engineers fell in love with their solutions. And then I tell them, economists taught me this, they need to create the goods. The good does not create the need. And then the last thing, most people don't think about it, took me years to understand that, is about saving customer time. How can you spoon in the value? How can you make it convenient with them? The company that wins is not the cheapest. Look at Apple. It's the one that makes things simple, easy to use, and save the end user time.
Or it leads to one of those delightful experiences, for sure. Yeah, where people just have that aha moment. I love that. Second to last question here. You've given so much good career advice. I usually ask for career advice at the end, but you've sprinkled so much of it throughout here. I love the idea of follow your effort. Ideally, obviously, it's your effort and your passion, but following your effort is such a good way to finding your passion. I love that career advice. Reflect a moment, though, on a mentor that you've had, somebody who has influenced you, what you've learned from them, a friend, family member, boss, peer. Reflect for a moment on some of the key lessons you've learned from a mentor.
I think it was a serial French entrepreneur early on. He was managing a global team, and everybody tell him how their country is unique, their company is unique, their culture is unique. And, you know, everybody, every company thinks they're unique. Everything thinks they're unique. Once you travel global, I was young. I remember him getting on the phone with everybody. Because every time he tried to push a company to standardize it, every country, every, as you can imagine, Graham, everybody tell you they're unique. One day he got all of us on the phone. He's like, look, guys, if you work for a profit business, I don't care anywhere in the world. I don't care your culture. I don't care your race. There is two activities. How you attract new customer, how you retain existing one. Okay, let me net it out for you guys. You work in engineering, you clean the bathroom, these things, those activities should be tied to those two activities. If it's not tied to those two, call me and cut the shit. Stop telling me how different you are. I think it took me years to appreciate that. Now, like I told you throughout this interview, it's about a customer, work backward for it. This was the simplest way of doing it. There is two activities for profit business. Attracting new customer and retaining them.
Guess what? It's the same for nonprofits as well. You still have to have people who want your services or need your services. I mean, I guess needs a little bit different, but and you still have to raise money because you have to pay for that. So I love that. Abdel, it's been amazing. So many good things in there. I'm still trying to process this master soap maker turned data scientist theme, but I love it. So we're going to go with that. Final question for you. Where can our listeners learn more from you, follow you, connect with you? Is it Data Bid Machine? Is it LinkedIn? Where's the best place to get in touch with you?
I think it's LinkedIn. I have my network post a lot of job. I sort of refer a lot of interesting article knowledge that I refer to my network. I think LinkedIn is probably the best.
That's fantastic. And for our listeners, we'll be sure to link up Abdel's profile there in our show notes. Abdel, so amazing to catch up with you again. And thank you so much for being on the show.
I appreciate it, Graham. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Developmentor podcast. If you like the show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Even better, please leave us a review. If you want to hear older episodes, leave feedback, or sign up to be a guest, please visit us at developmentor.com. If you'd like to support the show, there are three ways you can help out. 1. Make a donation via Patreon. 2. If you're a software engineer looking for your next gig and wanting to practice interviewing, use our referral link to the interviewing.io platform. And 3. Buy your next tech book from Manning Publications using our affiliate link. All of those links can be found at developmentor.com/support-us. That's SUPPORT-US, all one word. Most importantly, if you like this show, please tell your friends. Referrals are the lifeblood of any podcast. Finally, we here at Developmentor hope that each and every episode helps you move one step closer to finding your path.